Talkers.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 25. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey, and my guest this episode is my friend Stephen Christian, best known as the frontman for Amber Lynn. Stephen released a fourth album with his solo project, Anchor in Braille, in spring of 2020. He's also a pastor and worship leader, holds a master's degree, and has studied psychology, and maintains a passionate interest in nonprofit humanitarian work. Stephen and I had a fascinating conversation not only about the development of his personal belief system and adherence to the Christian faith, but also about the career arc of Anne Berlin, being on that rocket ship, going up into the stratosphere, and then the sort of plateauing and come down that's involved with that, and the turning point and crossroads that all professional musicians eventually seem to face, where their heart is pulled in other directions, real life, pragmatic practicalities come into play. I honestly think that that portion of our conversation is almost required listening for anyone who's thinking of starting a band, has started a band, at any point in that arc that you may be. I think you might get something out of the things we talk about and the insight that Stephen offers. Please make sure to subscribe to this podcast if you enjoy it. And the best way you can support us is to leave a 5-star rating and a nice little review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. You can check out past episodes and have a look at the newly relaunched and redesigned NoPrizeFromGod.com, which features deeper looks at some of our guests and some of the topics that we've talked about. No Prize from God is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network, which includes Speak and Destroy, a podcast about Metallica, and Pop Curse, which is musicians talking movies. So here it is, my conversation with Stephen Christian. This is No Prize from God. Skype says you're in Los Angeles, but I thought you were in Florida.
Yeah, I'm in Florida. I think I got set up on Skype in when I was living in LA for that year and a half. So
I was gonna say I thought that was a brief moment. I was like, man, am I that behind on?
Was no. It was a quick jaunt out there. Recorded a record, decided to stay, and then decided I don't even live here. I live nowhere. I live on a bus. So just
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Oh.
Are you in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I'm in Los Alamitos, which is the northernmost point of Orange County.
Okay.
So about 20 minutes from. But yeah, I grew up in Indiana, but I've been here since 2001 in various parts of California, nice. Southern California mostly.
Nice.
Yeah, man. So this podcast, basically the gist of it, the elevator pitch, I was looking at the religion and spirituality category. It's one of those things where I feel like most great creative works come from you're looking for something and it doesn't exist, and so you decide to create it. You know, you wish there was a band that sounded like this plus this, so then you just start one kind of thing.
There you go.
And it was a similar thing where I was, you know, looking for podcasts in that religion spirituality category, and the vast majority of what I was finding was either militant atheist stuff, new agey self-help stuff, or mainline right-wing evangelical prosperity gospel. Like, that was just like, you know, and I thought, where's the conversation about life's big questions for everyone else? And then I started thinking about, in the music world in particular, and then how that also branches out into film and television and a lot of other mediums, how many people I've come across or know or have been interested in that have really unique and interesting experiences and viewpoints on all of this stuff that doesn't fall into any of those categories I just mentioned, you know, that lives even a little bit outside. Even people that I know who are adherents to a particular faith tradition tend to be really interesting people who either came into it in some kind of sideways way or have like a different kind of take on it. So yeah, that was really the whole idea of the podcast was,
This podcast is No Prize from God.
Yes.
And then that, okay, and then do you have another podcast called Speak and Destroy, or is that just the email?
I have Speak and Destroy. Stream and Destroy is the email.
And Destroy, okay.
And Speak and Destroy is my podcast about Metallica.
Nice.
I just have people on that are either influenced by or were influences on or have some direct or indirect connection to Metallica, and we talk about Metallica for an hour. So yeah, I've had Gary Holt from Exodus, Rob Flynn from Machine Head, Matt from Avenged Sevenfold, Lizzie Hale from Hailstorm, and then I've also had, you know, the guy who engineered Kill 'Em All, who's like never done anything else you've heard of. I've had guys from Anti Nowhere League and Saxon and Diamondhead and like a bunch of those bands that influenced Metallica, and that's been fun.
Amazing, man.
Yeah, but that's been fun. So this one, yeah, it's been. I call it conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. So yeah, so anything that just that I come across that is like, well, that's trippy and weird and interesting.
Yeah,
I like to go for it. So
you need to get on is this incredible artist? Not an artist. I don't know if he paints, but he's an incredible author, speaker. He's probably like as close to a guru priest as I will ever come. It's a guy named Richard Rohr.
The name's familiar.
He's based out of Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Okay.
His I would say disciples are many in number, and many of them have gone on to do other great things. Chris and Felina Hewerts. They write a lot about contemplative prayer as well as the Enneagram. I'm sure you've heard of the Enneagram by now.
Mm-hmm.
Chris has written several books on the Enneagram.
Wow.
It's probably top five foremost voices on the Enneagram. So I could give you all this contact information. Now, Richard Rohr, that's out of my – he's next level. But and there's also – there's really my – I don't know, one of my – I don't even know what you call him. Closest, yeah, thing to me to my own personal priest is another guy, an author named Paul Pastors. He lives next to a convent out in the mountains of Oregon and is as close to the Zen master as I will ever come, you know, into knowing. So anyway, I got a couple cool names that would just be like just conversations that are just like, wait, what? You know, so.
This is already worth the price of admission. Yeah, I'm pretty soon. It's funny because he's been down to do it since I started the podcast, and it's me that's been putting it off. But a guy named Peter Rollins, who's a theologian, author, speaker, I've gotten to be friendly with him over the last couple of years, and his work, more so than any other in my own life, in my own faith walk, has been the most influential to me. And it's one of those things where it's kind of so big, and yeah, when you hear him talk, there's a lot of like, whoa, that even I, as someone who's a professional journalist that interviews people by trade, I'm like, I'm intimidated about having – he's not an intimidating guy at all, but I'm still kind of intimidated about, like, oh, what would that conversation even be, you know?
Yeah, I get it.
It's much more comfortable to talk to Ihsahn about church burnings and murders than to talk about faith and doubt and certainty and pyrotheology and all Peter's work. So yeah, man. So the one of the things I really enjoy doing is really digging into the formative years. And I grew up in Indianapolis, and Wikipedia says you were born in Kalamazoo, which, if you've toured and traveled a lot like you and I have, and lived in different parts of the country like we have, Indiana and Michigan, we may as well have grown up next door to each other.
That is very true.
I learned that when I first got to Southern California. My office mate, just, luck of the draw, my office mate, who's still one of my very close friends, was from Iowa. And I don't know that I'd ever even really been to Iowa very much, probably just driven through it a bunch. But the two of us in an office in Santa Monica at MTV together, it was like we'd known each other all of our lives. And it felt, and he was also the only other believer that I, not to say that there aren't plenty of others at that company, but at the time he was the only other person of faith that I knew and was in regular conversation with. So it was just really interesting how that, we would appear to have nothing in common, but then put in that environment, it was like we had everything in common.
No,
So yeah, so tell me a little bit about early Stephen Christian life.
do we want the religious kind of the religious aspect, or are we talking about
A
just the
little bit, just
whole
kind of in
world?
general, like, two parent household, single parent siblings, and then it, when and where ideas of faith and that sort of stuff entered your life.
So I grew up in a traveling family, which I'll explain in just a second. I had two parents, big family, both sides kind of coming from out of Michigan, the St. Joe Benton Harbor, Niles area. And but my father would move around a lot. He would, we would be, I lived in 12 different places the first 12 years of my life. I have three younger siblings, and they were inevitably my best friends, in some way, shape, or form, simply because, again, moving around that much doesn't allow for many deep connections. Faith was always a part of my life, since day zero. It was ingrained in me from my parents. Both sets of grandparents were passionately involved with the church. My grandfather's story, my opa from the Ukraine, was met Jesus by a missionary over there. And just the amount of stress, strain, crazy stories, mythological to anyone else outside of my family who would know them to be true by eyewitness accounts, escaping from communist Russians from the Ukraine into Nazi Germany, and then finding their way underground through refugee camps out to free Germany, and then it finally eventually making it over to the United States. They were very much thankful and grateful to obviously the Judeo-Christian God. My grandparents on the other side were very much ingrained, same difference, not so much the war-torn testimony, but more like, this is all we know, this is what we've known, we've been raised in the church. My grandfather got saved pretty early on, I want to say about 19 years old, 18 years old, out of a life of, at that time, I'm sure was very much like scrutinized, but we would know it as just, occasional drinker and dancer, and, but at the time that was the misfit. But from those moments on, I think, that side of the family was very much Christian. And I, when I say saved, I do mean like just simply a belief. As you and I would call, saved, would just be a belief that Jesus died and was resurrected by God. And so, but growing up, we had gone to my parents went from both of them were raised Baptists. We went to an Assemblies of God church. That was, I feel, at the time was incredible for my parents. They truly were invested into many different revivals, or as the Pentecostal would call outpourings around the country, around other countries, that I feel was very detrimental to my faith early on, because I felt like Pentecostals, and this is again, I don't want to say to each his own. What I will say is I love and respect my father, and if he says this is an experience that happened to me, I don't know any different than not to trust him. So I do believe some people out there, experiencing God in that way, truly are. Just as I believe there's somebody in a Catholic church who's by themselves right this moment weeping, experiencing God in that way. I've never known God in either of those situations. So when I was growing up, you know, there would be, if you study any of the Pentecostal movies, movements from the 90s or 2000s, early 2000s, it was a lot of emotional upheaval, very much self-conjuring in my interpretation. Mm-hmm. For other people's experiences with a God through these kind of laughing or running around the church, or
that's where you hear speaking in tongues and even maybe snake handling and faith healing and that sort of stuff.
Healing, and you know, they would say, you know, hanging from chandeliers is an old expression. But in my mind, in my 16-year-old mind, I said, if A is true, which is there is a God, plus B, that he shows himself, reveals himself to mankind through these emotional experiences, and I wasn't experiencing it, therefore equals that God does not exist.
Yeah, that's sort of the Jenga piece that you pulled out of your faith tower.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And so from around 16 to age 18, I feel like I was very much into the social element of church. It was a social life. Again, I didn't have many friends growing up from 0 to 12. And so now I had found a social group that accepted me for...
And when you say traveling, how long would you be in any given place through your childhood?
The shortest in a place would have been South Carolina. We lived there for about 2 months, and the longest would be 2 years tops. Tops.
Wow, man, two months somewhere when you're a kid. I mean, that's ever, you know, when you think about, you know, we were joking earlier before we got on about the mysterious ebb and flow of time during shelter in place. But when you're a kid, you know, it's like the 5 years is so much more to you when you're 15 than, you know, the age 10 to 15 than what 5 years becomes in your 20s, 30s, 40s. Man, to only be somewhere for a couple of months is just this. Yeah, that had to be difficult. Yeah, how do you maintain any bonds in terms of friendships and that sort of thing? And obviously, you know, we're of a generation that it's not like you were texting with your friends in South Carolina as soon as you left. That didn't exist.
No. And also, like, as far as, you know, school systems, every time you move, a new school system has a new set of rules and ways to educate you. And so, yeah. Therefore, I mean, I got so far behind in schooling.
More teachers that you have to say, no, it's PH, it's not V. Yep. It's just literally every ground zero part of you has to
that
be
is very true.
Reestablished in a new place.
And that was tough. And that was, but around the age of, so again, from 16 to 18, I would call it more of a social, you know, consciousness as far as why I wanted to go to church. You know, finally we had.
So you're getting enrichment and enjoyment out of just the fellowship, being around other people, but you're also questioning, like, hey, all this supernatural stuff that everyone around me seems to be experiencing, I don't feel that.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, and I didn't have a choice. It wasn't like I was like, hey, guys, can we go to a different non-denominational church right down the way? So it was just tough. But again, that experience happened. And then so around age 18, I went to on a mission trip. My grandmother basically said, hey, listen, if you go on this missions trip, I'll help pay the bulk of the finances. Well, in my 17 and a half year old mind, I thought to myself, man, what a great escape. What a great escape from high school, from, you know, parents and, you know, finding myself and individuality. And you add it all up, you know, let's go. So at the time I had, you know, very long surfer hair, you know, I surfed at the time. And so I went on this mission trip and I went to go into Miami, Florida. And the whole presentation was a drama presentation to locals. And I was going to the Ukraine, and I chose the Ukraine because that's where my family was from. I had never been, just wanted to kind of see where my roots were from. And so when I was in Miami, Florida, you know, they said, okay, we're giving out drama parts. You know, who's going to play it? I wanted to play the character of Death. He wore a black robe and he had a big sickle and he walked around and he had one part and it was over and I could go back to exploring the Ukraine. Well, at the end of the time when they were delving out parts, I'm noticing that the character of Jesus is not being handed out. And I'm telling, when I say I phoned it in, I was doing, they're like, show me happy. And I was like, happy, show me sad. I'm trying to
Lion
not just
face,
get,
roar, lemon face. Ooh.
I'm trying to learn that death character part with a giant blade.
You're like, I am projecting death. Void.
Absolutely. So, at the time, at the kind of narrowed down, I was the last one, and they said, okay, Stephen, and you're going to be playing Jesus. Well, at that moment, it was like a blunt object just hit my chest, because in the same way that I always thought, even as an early Christian, like I thought it was funny with metal that they would wear the pentagrams, because in my head, even though I was kind of like very, not acute, not in the know, I always thought, like, man, even if I didn't believe in Satan, I don't know if I'd play around with that. I don't know.
Right. Why
I don't
the risk versus reward of
the Pascal's wager here came into effect in my little mind, and I was like, I don't know if I just play. I don't know why. Well, the same logic was placed on this. Like, oh my gosh, here I am playing a character, and I'm not sure. I applied the same theory. Why would I do that? Why would I play this character? And what if it exists? Am I going to get, like, I'm not saying God's a Thor God, he's going to come out and smite you out of heaven, but I also had a little bit of reverence for what my grandparents' was experiences were, my parents. So that night, I went up to my hotel room. I was all by myself. Everybody else was meeting downstairs, and it was lightning outside. And this, and
No
just,
pun
it was,
intended. You're waiting to be struck by.
yeah. And so, I remember the rains came down, and I just went out on the balcony, and I had my, I think the closest thing to my, what's that, Lieutenant Dan moment, to where, I got out on that balcony in the middle of the lightning and thunder and rain, and just started yelling. And then at that moment, after I got it all out and I'm in tears, just like, where are you, God? Kind of just having my little battle as if I could ever win that. It kind of dawned on me that I was literally having a conversation, which presupposed in my own head that I'm talking to something, therefore something had to exist. Now, what that was it the Judeo-Christian? Was it Odin? I'm not sure. I don't know, but I definitely, everything within me was, just pouring out. And even the Bible says you work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And a lot of people, they say, well, when I met Jesus, it felt like honey came all over me, or I felt this peace that just, it wasn't that for me. It was another blunt object that was just kind of like a catharsis that I'm talking to something externally that I could not visibly see, but also that, at that moment, it existed. It existed. And so I went on the trip, just kind of like, hey, I'm at least going to be, open to the idea that there is a God. Let me start from scratch. Because being raised in a Christian home has its advantages, but it also has a disadvantage in that you've only learned the theology of your parents and of teachers and Sunday school teachers, and you're picking up actions here and words here, and sermons from a very finite group of individuals. So, I began to just study the red letters, and that's a fancy way of saying I just looked back at just the teachings of Jesus, not the Testament, not the New Testament, to try to dissect what was the noise and the rattle of a church compared to, like, what was the foundational truth of what they would have called their God, their God incarnate, their Jesus himself. And what I found was the most altruistic story of my entire life, one that I felt human could not create, because it's the antithesis of everything I want. I want to go get hammered. I want to go, like, sleep around with it. I mean, the barbaric human in me wants to go sleep with everyone, wants to go experience the drugs, wants to go, all this just maddening, wants to be my own God, wants to be rich and powerful and greedy and all the things that my nature says. And here's a guy that's doing literally the antithesis, who saying it is better to give than to receive, who is healing the poor, who is ministering and telling the children to come to him, which was faux pas back then. You don't talk to children, you don't associate, you don't bless children, you don't talk to women. When the Jews would have said, praise God that I wasn't born a dog or a woman, and here's a Jew talking to women healing them and telling them about real life and life more abundantly. And to me, I was just like,
And sinners, talking
and
to sinners,
sinners
everyone,
yeah,
to a man, to a woman. Yeah.
Prostitutes, and James had it right, a couple to the right of the red letters. He said, and this is pure religion, is to love the widows and orphans and keep himself unspotted from the world. And that's what drew me in, was just the utter altruism, the utter,
It's interesting when you talk about it running counter to your more base sort of primitive intuitions. When you think about the commandment, the greatest of all commandments, right? To love thy neighbor as thyself. And you think about even our culture, for all of the advancements in technology and medicine and, all of the wondrous moments of human achievement since the time of Jesus walking the earth, that still runs so counter to who most of us are, right? Like, 'cause we don't love our neighbor as ourselves. We distrust and fear and recoil from our neighbor by nature. It's like where everyone's out to get us and we're suspicious and we're always on guard. And so, yeah, to think about just how profound that simple commandment really is and how hard it is. People think about the Christian faith and in terms of rules and, don't do this and don't do that. And man, that's the loving your neighbor as yourself is probably the hardest rule to follow. As hard as that is for us all to admit, because we all want to think of ourselves as loving and giving. But at the end of the day, our culture teaches us to be very distrustful of our neighbors.
True, very true. And then our nature, ego, is completely egocentric. You can't, I don't know, a lot of people are altruistic, but it's a learned behavior or a learned response or something that faith dictates or perhaps their parents.
Or performative, as people like to say these days.
Yeah.
A performative altruism. Look at me.
Yes.
Yeah.
I totally agree. But, again, going back to that's what that was the lure for me into knowing more about Jesus Christ. And so they're on that trip after kind of weeks and weeks of every morning they would say, get up and have an hour long devotion time, and by yourself. And so after weeks of this, just studying this guy, Jesus, and then, already knowing kind of the history and a lot of things that I was, again, some of the positives of being raised in a church was I felt like I knew what the next steps to do with my walk I believed in my heart after kind of studying those particular scriptures. I knew my faith wasn't going to look like my parents. That's, I knew that for sure. And perhaps the denominational choices that they chose growing up and what they chose to, to participate in even at that current moment. However, I knew that my path and trajectory was for the faith of the way or Christianity. And on that trip, there was a time when I was talking to an elderly lady. And the Iron Curtain had just fallen, so the entire Ukrainian culture's demeanor was very heavy set, dark. And I'm not talking about weight. I'm talking about like almost a spiritual weight, an aura of heaviness. And to tell her about Jesus and what I had experienced and saying, and saying someone loves you, someone cares about you, someone, knew you, knows your name. And she lit up and she started to cry and cry. Well, at the same time, there was a man about – I would say 39 to 45 years old. And at the time I had just turned 18, and he was to my right and he had horn rim glasses on, black, bowl cut for the most part all around. And he's watching me talk and he's watching her and he's watching me and he's watching her. And I'm telling him all this and he just stops. He goes, stop. So do you really believe this? Do you really believe this? And it was that morning, that moment when I just stopped and looked internally, was just like, oh my gosh, am I reciting this? Do I believe it? And I said, yes. And something like a sonar pulse is the only way I could describe it. I just went boom, 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 boom. And the Bible says, confessing with your mouth and believing your heart. And that's the only thing you need to do to be saved, to find your way to Jesus Christ. And whatever that is, I felt the final kind of connection that I believed it in my heart and I had confessed it with my mouth. And so it was at that moment when I chose my my path that I'm currently on.
You know, and isn't that interesting? Because I think that's something people that grew up without any sort of faith tradition at all, let alone, a Judeo-Christian one. There's such, to me, and this comes up in these conversations on this podcast, which I'm really thankful for. There's a difference between being raised in something and the moment when that is you've so beautifully described, when you discover it and embrace it for yourself. And that isn't to say that as parents we shouldn't raise our children up in our faith, but there's got to be this understanding, right, of like at some point it has to be what they choose for themselves, or what is it even? It is just, yeah, maybe it's some nice moral codes to live by and some great friendship and community and I'm not to I don't mean to be dismissive of those aspects of any of the world's faiths, but there is something that I think gets overlooked too often in conversation, which is like there's gotta be room. You gotta give enough space for a person to, whether they're 16, 17, whether they're 30, whenever it happens, for them to have their own encounter that's meaningful and finally, ties it all together for them, where they're like, oh,
Absolutely.
okay.
I'm a pastor, and my wife and I early on, when we had children, basically said, we're never going to coerce. We're never going to say you have to, you must. This has to be their decision. I mean, it says in the Bible, train up a child in the way, in the bent that they're, that they're supposed to go. And so we want to give them all the knowledge, but I will never say to my child, you better walk up to that altar. You better go find, it's not, that can't happen, because even though the Old Testament, the Talmud says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Yeah, that's great, and I agree. But they're also, like you're saying, there has to come a point in time where there's the age of responsibility, to where they have to, answer to not just their dad, they now have to answer to a much, much higher power. And because of that, yeah, you're absolutely right. They need to be free.
And there's an emotional and intellectual maturity that has to take place in order for that to really take hold. And it's funny how it all kind of comes full circle, because I'm also, one of my favorite things about scripture is the talk of a childlike faith, which is for me as an adult what I eventually fell into, that kind of full circle moment, right? And instead of trying to overthink and outsmart God, when I decided to adopt that more childlike faith look is when things really transformed for me. But at the same time, though, yeah, what I'm getting at is at a certain point, as we develop as humans, you inevitably come to a crossroads where you kind of go, okay, this is what I grew up with, this is what I was taught, but is this what I believe? And it sounds like you had a very powerful, definitive experience with that.
Absolutely.
I think it's
Absolutely.
important. So where does music enter in the equation for you, both in terms of being inspired by it and then that inevitable crucial turning point where you went from, okay, music is something I enjoy versus this is something I have to participate in. I got to be part of it. I want to make it. I want to be on stage. I want to, perform. What was, so tell me about music kind of being introduced into your life and then that turning point of, all right, I'm not just going to be someone who loves music. I'm going to be someone who his part is in it.
Yeah, so I both, luckily for me, both the sets of my family, my grandparents on either side, both sides, were very musically inclined. Just every Christmas, every family gathering would somehow inevitably end into mass singing sessions, lots of hymns, choral, my choral, music, violin, somebody played trumpet, my piano, just. There was a lot of instruments. My grandfather, who I only met, I only remember meeting once. I'm sure I had several encounters with him when I was a child, but he died before I got to know him. But my opa, from the Ukraine, he was said to have played 12 different instruments. And even in the refugee, every refugee camp they went into, he would assemble a choir and an orchestra. So it was very much genetic. And culturally, a part of like who I was just being around music. And I, at the
That's
time, I just,
awesome.
every family was like this.
Yeah, you take it for granted.
That four part harmonies were not kind of like a weird an oddity for me. Four part harmonies were just very natural, like just like my dad's on bass and she's doing soprano and they're just all singing in unison. It didn't, it never occurred to me like, oh man, like this, how do all these people genetically know how to sing? This is crazy. Again, it was, I was around it culturally in my family. And again, I think it's a big genetic part of, I feel that you're pretty much predispositioned to sing or not. It just is. I think it's in the same way you could say, oh man, I would love to be 6'2". There's you can do to help that. You can get some risers for your shoes. You can maybe do some stretching and have, medically have them stretch you. But honestly, you're either 6'2" or you're just not. So singing, that's why, vocally, I can't really take any credit. It's not like people are like, great voice. And I'm like, oh, I know. It's kind of like, I don't know, thank my grandparents,
Yeah, it's
thank
like
my
somebody being
mom.
like, nice bone structure. Like,
Yeah,
yeah.
exactly.
Thanks, I worked
So,
very hard at it.
yes, I did. These cheekbones didn't grow them. Yeah, that's what I did. So I was always around it. Well, coming up, we stopped traveling when I was about 12, 12, 13 years old in Winter Haven, Florida. Winter Haven is a was at the time about 27,000 people, very much a redneck community. I mean, it's to this day very much orange groves, pickup trucks, and whatever your mind, insinuates that to, that little town to look like is exactly on point. Well, it's either that, you'd either go get drunk with the rednecks in the orange groves or you start a band. And luckily for me, there was a lot of great local bands, Syrup, Faceless, just a bunch of just all these like, coat hanger, all just a bunch of them, a bunch of bands that would play at this little place called Friar Tuck's. And again, I was really drawn into the community gang-like atmosphere, because of having no friends as soon as a few would accept, and as you know, the underground is very accepting. You know what I'm saying? If you're, I don't care if you're a metalhead, punk rocker, I don't care. It's a gang.
You're
They
like,
assemble.
these are my people. This is my
They are.
family. We found each other. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And because Winter Haven was so small, all those people, the metal people, the post everything hardcore, whatever you want to call it, they all melded. There was probably like 35 of us. You know what I'm saying? But out of that 35,
Which
I
in a
would.
town of that size, that's like an army.
It is.
Yeah.
And out of the 35, probably 25 of us were in bands. So I was in a crappy band. The guy next to me is in a crappy band, and we're all just kind of like hanging out, watching, the local scene kind of grow.
Yeah, it's like that thing where five bands play a show together and the audience is basically the other
Oh,
four bands while you're playing.
they're either playing the show or they're going to play next week at the show. And it was a very accepting culture. Got to know some of them through because they went to my high school and someone had graduated my high school. And so I just right around the age of 18, 19, I began to form a punk rock band with some friends and called Saga. And it was horrific. We were the worst band alive. However, it kind of propelled me into saying, I want to take this seriously. I love the invigoration. I love the emotional aspect of it. It was, I want to say punk rock, but the band was so bad, it gives an insult. It's an insult to
Well,
all punk
what were some of
bands.
the reference points that you guys were sharing and drawing from in terms of what who you wanted to sound like?
I mean, the bands that we wanted to sound like, I would say, was Avail and Hot Water
Oh
Music.
wow. Yeah, well, I mean that's very Hot Water Music. It's very Florida of you.
A very Avail is another. I think Avail kind of started that sound, and Hot Water kind of was right under that. And then we wished we could, but we couldn't. But we tried our best. And then some of the guys were super into like Face to Face, so there's a lot of melodies involved there. And obviously Green Day, and just that whole just hodgepodge. I'm trying to think of like just Rancid was a big one, big influence. Just all that kind of like that kind of lumped together. Every song sounded different, but I definitely felt like, oh man, I love this energy. And a lot of bands that we could play with were very much hardcore. And so that's kind of where we gleaned our stage presence from was because to us, like we saw a bunch of bands that would just stand still and not move. And for us, it was kind of like, no, I've seen energy. I want to portray that energy, even though our music sounds like this or is a different vein of rock. You'll never see us standing still. It's we've got to move around. So, that's just the visuals that I grew up with in watching and being excited about seeing. And
you're like, Avail has a guy in the band who doesn't even play anything. He just jumps around.
So did we. His name was
You had a Bobo?
We really, really did.
That's
and he
awesome.
Was great. We had a great time with him. He didn't really do anything. He just jumped around the stage, jumped in the alt crowd, and
nice.
Dude, he was the best. We loved
I always
it.
Think about Avail, obviously, and the Boston's. That's the other group I think about, where it's like there's just some dude up there. It's
there
awesome,
is.
Though.
Yeah, there is. Isn't Dropkick Murphys, is there one? I'm not sure.
Gosh, there's so many people in that band. I don't know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised.
He could have been there.
I know that the
know.
Band photo is like, a gazillion people, so.
Yep, that's very true. So, that's where kind of like where music kind of started. That's where it was birthed from.
So I know that's amazing. And so I know a lot of our mutual friends probably too that were raised in Christian households and really into music. There was always a schism of butting up against of the so-called secular music and Christian bands. And I know a lot of people whose first few loves were, the Christian music scene out of necessity because their parents were like, well, you can listen to that music, but they better be Christian bands. It doesn't sound like you had that problem because it seems like you were familiar with a lot of general market, I'm doing air quotes, artists. Was there any kind of push and pull or give and take there in the household as far as what you were listening to and...
Oh yeah, man. Oh yeah. I mean, I was not allowed to listen to air quotes general market secular music, whatever you want to call it. That was not a thing. I think one of the greatest moments or failures of my life, depending on how you want to call it, is that I was in South Carolina, living there, like I mentioned, for only 2 months, and I went over to my neighbor's house. He invited me over, and I walked in there and I looked, I looked at all his posters in his room, and I was like, who are all these women? And he's like, oh, what are you talking about? This is heavy metal, man. And I was like, heavy? Oh, I was like, oh, you know what? I was like, I love heavy metal. He's like, yeah, right. And I was like, no, I do. I like heavy stuff. And he's like, really? He's like, yeah, come here. Let me play this tape. I wish this I could make this up. Took him over to my house, popped in a tape, plopped it in. I pushed around. I knew exactly where. Push play, and here comes this classical stuff. Dun, 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 dun. And he was like, this isn't heavy metal. I was like, just wait, it's about to kick in. It's building. And then suddenly Amy Grant goes, Hal should die. Echo Adonai.
I thought you were going to say Striper, which was already going to be like,
oh, man.
Amazing.
Ever talk to me again, ever. I couldn't believe it. I had just played. You should go listen to that song, Al Shaddai. Listen to the buildup and know at that moment I was trying to tell someone it was heavy metal.
Oh, I'll edit that into the episode.
You should. It's powerful, man. It's a powerful song.
Oh, that's
man,
amazing.
Real touching.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's like some office style cringe humor. That's like a scene you would write in a sitcom now.
And I wouldn't believe it if I watched it. I'd be like, yeah, right, that's never happened. That wouldn't happen.
I love that you were looking at his posters and you were like, who are all these chicks on the wall?
I know. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. But I was very much, it wasn't until much later in life, till my late teenage years, that I heard Led Zeppelin. I remember hearing Kiss for the first time and thinking it was a joke. I was like, no, play me Kiss for real. Because, see, in my little Christian head, that's Knights in Satan's service. So
right.
I'm thinking, yeah, Satan, yeah. Watch yeah. blood, Christians. You know, I don't know.
Yeah,
that's
you
what
thought
my
Kiss
head...
was going to be deicide.
Yeah. You know, what is it, Christian Cannibal or Christian Death or Cannibal Corpse? So I just, all these, that's what I was assuming. And so it was like, I would like to rock and roll. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Really? Play me Kiss. I've heard all about these guys. I've seen their faces as they're the Christian poster childs of what Satanism looks like.
Yeah. Meanwhile, it's a couple of Christian or a couple of Jewish guys and a couple of Italian guys from the Bronx or whatever. Just like, yo, we want to write some love songs.
Yeah, let's write the greatest marketing team of all time. Man, Anyway, it's so yes, I wasn't really exposed early on to a lot of different.
You know, who I just had on the podcast a couple episodes ago is Blackie Lawless from the band Wasp, which of course was "We Are Sexual Perverts" and and this and this and that. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but Blackie was saved at some point and still does Wasp, but doesn't perform a handful of those songs. And the episode we did was like a Bible study. He's like, recites chapter and verse. And, a very interesting story that he has, because at one point in that wall in that Wasp era, at their height, his girlfriend was a witch, and he was super into the occult and going to ritual stuff. And yeah, he's come all the way around to the Lord and has been visiting historical sites, trying to retrace the Paul's steps, and just a complete turnaround. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, a lot of those bands that we thought of as evil, it's like they're not evil, they're just like dorks. Even Slayer, who are like kind of the poster, the band that you would hold up as like the biggest almost mainstream like satanic band, it's like you had one guy in the band who's a hardcore atheist, and that one's about it. No one in the band worships Satan. The singer who's singing those lyrics that he's not writing is a Catholic who's going to mass with his family on the weekends. But it's like, as a kid though, it's like it's a very it's seems very different. And then you kind of grow up and you're like, ah, these are just dudes like any other dudes you might meet somewhere for
Like
better or worse.
I've I'm the same difference with the band Ghost. These are they said, like I was talking to a mutual friend and they were just like, dude, these guys are complete dads. I mean, they are at picnics and on at the park on the weekends. They they are driving their little Audi TTs around. It's just funny. They're
Yeah,
just like
you think of them as in like a castle around a Ouija board, like levitating, writing their records, and it's like, nah, they got to get off GarageBand because they got to go pick up the kids from daycare.
Yeah, it's so true. That's great. I might stop by the Home Depot on the way home after. Do you mind, babe? Okay, thanks.
So before Anne Boleyn really took over in your life, you were following sort of the more traditional, college and that sort of thing. What sort of path were you on initially before the band kind of took over and you were like, oh, I gotta be full-time band guy?
I was sure that I was going into nonprofit work. I didn't know whether I wanted to be the president of UNICEF or World Vision, but I was aiming at something and just heading that way. So I was graduating from the University of Central Florida and I was working for this place called Catholic Heart at work camps. And they basically were just that. They were work camps like in the summer. It'd be like Habitat for Humanity for Catholics. So they would go into a city, they would help build and reconstruct housing or fix roofs or start or work with Habitat for Humanity. And during the week they would have games and shows and all that and stuff like, well, I would, I was like a full-time staff member there. And when I was going to leave University of Central Florida, they had offered me a job to go work there. So I was ecstatic, ecstatic. I was talking about, let's make this an international venture. Let's go to the next level. We were talking about which countries we wanted to take this to. Well, right about, I would say about 3 or 4 weeks prior to me graduating UCF, I'm having conversations with the guys in the band, just saying, hey, I wanted to let you know, as soon as I'm out of college, I'm going in this direction. I'm going, to work nonprofit. So we're going to have to, kind of call it quits on Anne Boleyn. And we kind of all agreed on a timeline and
So they were
so.
they, there wasn't a whole bunch of resistance where they're like, no, you can't do that. They were like, okay, we get it. Like,
Yeah, because it wasn't just me. It was all of us. It was kind of like, well, I mean, we weren't really going anywhere. We had just recorded some demos for Matt Goldman in Atlanta, Georgia. And we were just kind of like getting a little bit of buzz, but nobody's asking us to tour. No record labels are reaching out. So about 2 weeks before I graduate from UCF, my boss takes me for a ride. He takes me for a drive. We have to go to literally Home Depot to go pick up supplies to go help a building, this to help build. And we're talking and he said, man, I just want to let you know that once you graduate, you no longer have a job here. We're going to move on. We're going to go in a different direction. And I was shocked. I mean, I was replaying everything I did. Did I say something wrong? What did he not want to go international? Was I too aggressive? Like, what did I do? And he never told me. Even to this day, I think about like six, I want to say about 4 months ago, I reached out to him after all these years and just said, "Hey, thank you. Thank you for firing me. I don't know why." And I didn't ask. I just said, "I appreciate that. It just kind of life works out the way it should. All things work out for the good for those who serve, God and all this stuff. So thank you. I appreciate whatever voice you were listening to. That's it, it only helped." And he responded, that his kids were big fans and he's excited to where I was. But at the time, I had nowhere else to go. And so right after I graduated in the end of May, and at the end of June, Amberlynn got their first contract. Like, we signed our first contract. We had some other interest from other labels and stuff like that, but we finally ended up
You could
signing to
certainly
them in
make
September.
a case for the idea that God was clearing the way for you.
Yeah,
Because imagine
he
having
really
to make that
giving
decision
me zero
as
options.
opposed to,
That's great, man.
I mean,
That's
this
great.
decision's
That's
been
great.
made for you. This is what you're going to do. Yeah, that's amazing. And then, so take me through, obviously we don't need to do the Amberlynn behind the music. I won't torture you with that. But obviously the band, as bands tend to do, had that cycle where, up, 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 and then you kind of hit that plateau, and then you're on cruise control. And I think, because we grew up watching, U2 and Metallica and all of these bands that are really one in a million, lightning in a bottle, the chances of not only reaching that level of commercial success, but of sustaining a lineup for that matter, and, the consistency of operating a certain level, it just doesn't really happen, So even I found that in the underground scene in particular, bands often become really disillusioned at that first the first moment that it's not up, 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 up. And I'm reminded of an interview I saw with Duff McKagan once on CNN. It was actually during the time he was out of Guns N' Roses, and he was talking about how he'd gotten into he got like an economics degree or something, and he was doing wealth management for musicians. And he was saying, the problem is when a band has some success, they don't have anyone around them saying, okay, like you guys are playing 5,000 seaters, you've got a gold record, your singles in the top 10. This could be as good as it gets. So let's make some plans. What are some other things you're interested in? Start some businesses. Figure out a way to kind of sustain still being a musician, but this and that. He was like, no, the person that says that to them gets fired for not believing in them. Everyone around a band says, top 10 single, we're going to number one. 5,000 seaters, we're going to 10,000 seaters. You got a gold record, we're going platinum. And while it's important to have that drive and that ambition, that sort of reasoned management of expectations doesn't seem to be very common in the music business. Now I think Amberlynn, is more blessed than many bands in the sense that, people still care about the band, people still follow what you're doing outside of the band. But what can you tell me about that time where, was there a moment or a season in your life where you kind of went like, okay, this is drawing to a natural conclusion. This has served its purpose and, I'm feeling called to ministry, to, worship leader, the different things that have evolved in your life. What was that season like for you?
I mean,
It's a big question, I know. I'm sorry.
it came in phases. It came in phases, that's for sure. It wasn't like a, and then I woke up, and then I decided I didn't want to be in the band. So, I would say when we hit the major label, the band, and I'm gonna leave this ambiguous for many, many different reasons. The band made some decisions that I didn't agree with. And I felt right then and there kind of like a proverbial the passion was lost. It was kind of just like, I think anybody
And
understands.
we can keep it vague, but when you say decisions, do you mean artistic or professional or
Professional, there was and Yeah, professional. And it, as you know, it goes hobby, passion, and then profession. And finally, when we hit this profession level, I was just kind of like, okay, I don't feel like we're all taking on this, we're not all thinking alike. And so I'm going to stop there. So that was the what phase one. And then the phase two, I think for me, happened at so kind of from that moment, I realized I've got to not watch out for myself and I've got to take care of myself. It was more kind of like just that, just the Duff McKagan saying, I've got a plan for the future. So from there, I started a little record label to put out my side, Danker and Brand. I started, I was really invested with some friends into this thing called Faceless International. It was a nonprofit. I was helping them with marketing. I was getting my master's degree at that time. And that's when I started to get my master's degree. I realized that like I could be in this for another week, for another 5 years, 10 years. I just don't know. So I need to start like chess moving and playing three moves ahead. That was a bum out for everybody else in the band because it definitely looked like my focus was not primarily on Amberlynn, but honestly, it wasn't. That was kind of that was just not the way I viewed it anymore. So that's kind of the initial like, okay, planting some seeds in the ground. I need to start working on a plan B. And then I remember exactly where we were. I was in Los Angeles, California. We were playing a show for K-Rock. I'm standing outside with my manager.
Which, if
I
people
went.
don't know, they're listening, K-Rock is the most influential rock radio station in the
Yes.
country.
And
And,
I was.
it was responsible for breaking a lot of bands in the alternative sort of
Yes.
scene. And they do big festivals here in California. And,
Including Amberlynn. Amberlynn would not have been where we are. I would not be sitting here, maybe perhaps talking to you, if it was not for K-Rock pushing through Feel Good Drag to number one, which everyone else jumped on the band
Yes, and
train.
that, and I should point that out too, that that's how it works in the music industry. If you get traction at K-Rock, that's when the other rock radio, the whole format, then looks at you and goes, "Oh, okay, that it's the cred that you need
Yep,
for
it's the
them to take a
validation.
chance."
We call it tastemaker. They are the tastemaker in rock radio. So we were. I was standing there. We were just about to play a show for them. I cannot remember which one in particular. I'm sure if I just did some quick
Weenie
history.
Roast or Inland Invasion or one of those
Thing.
things, yeah.
I was standing outside with him, and I knew that like we just released "Dark Is the Way" with Brendan O'Brien producing, and I knew how much that cost.
Yeah.
And he
Stone
had
Temple
said.
Pilots and, all these huge K-Rock records had been done by Brendan O'Brien
Oh
over
yes, oh yes.
Rage Against the Machine, I
Pearl
think.
Jam. Yep, you name it. And so we're standing outside of this K-Rock event, and I knew that my A&R would talk to me a lot more than he would talk to, let's say the manager or but it'd be more like, even the more than the band. He loved to put pressure on me. I don't know why, but he would just say things like, "Man, if this record fails, it's on your back and on your shoulders." I'm just kind of like, "Thanks, guy." But he said, he said to
Yikes.
me basically, "Yeah, this record will look like this will be a failure if it sells less than 19,000 first week." And in my mind, that was completely doable because our other records had sold 30,000 plus the prior three records, 30,000 plus first week. And so it seemed doable. I had put in the extra work, I had put in the effort, but then you got to remember this is the initial years of, Apple Music, YouTube, and Spotify, and obviously we're post Napster, kind of late stage LimeWire. But I thought for sure we could definitely beat 20,000.
And
That
this is
was
when
my.
you're still talking about, like, we got to get in the circular on the Powerwall at Best Buy, and
Yeah.
if we can be a loss leader and they can sell it for, I remember it was when the Seosin record came out and it was $4.99 at Best Buy. It was like the most
Yeah.
convoluted, like, we're gonna force a big first week. All
Yeah.
the tricks and the fans aren't aware, all this shenanigans that go on
Oh,
behind the scenes.
it's deep. Well, we sold 17,100, and I knew, because and the band we always talked, the drummer Nate and I always talked about, like, we wanted to leave the band right here. We were not going to be in back in the van, curmudgeoned old 50-year-olds like, "Damn kids, I wish they would, that stupid music. I can't. Why were they going to,
Mad about the band that opened for you 2 years ago that now you're opening for.
Yeah,
Rawr.
we're not going to do that, and that's kind of led us to why we quit when we quit. was just, and but I felt like that was at that second I was here. I had reached as high. I had done the, you know, like you said, you know, we are, you know, your analogy was we were in a 5,000 room and we were top 10 single, and we had a top 5 single on K-Rock, you know, at that moment. And I just knew the writing is on the wall. And from that moment on, you know, I loved being in the band those first years up to that second, because it felt like every week there was a new phone call. Guess what? Linkin Park wants to take you out. Guess what? You know, My Chem wants to take you out. Guess how many records you sold? Can you believe it? You know, this. And that was the moment where it was like, it was few, the phone calls got fewer and fewer and fewer. And you just kind of like,
and now instead of the conversations about how are we going to manage all of this exciting stuff around us, it becomes, what are we going to do about all this stuff around it? You know, it's like it immediately is just,
yeah,
the tone of everything just changes on a dime.
Yeah, it was a very proactive band. And then it suddenly in that moment became reactionary. You know, like, I don't
know. That's such a good way to put it. The different. Yes, that's the thing. That's the turning point. From yep. proactive to reactionary. Yeah, now you're reacting to things.
And I don't know if any of the other guys put all that together. And I don't even know if I mentioned that to my manager. I know I said something in that moment. In that moment, I was just kind of like, okay, Kyle, well, that's it. You know, I don't remember what I said, but I remember alluding to it, you know, that was the moment. And I probably could just figure out the exact date of Amberlynn's pinnacle and you know, meteoric, not fall, but just kind of like the descension. Yeah. Because I mean, all I have to do is look at the first.
And again, yours was way less severe than 100 other bands we could talk about. But when you're living it and it's the number one thing in your life, you know, in this earthly life anyway, you're not thinking about like, oh, you're not thinking about the 1,000 bands you have it better than. You're thinking about the 10 bands that have it better than you. That's just the nature of it. You know, that's just.
Of course, man. Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were at K. I remember because we were at a K-Rock event and we were just leaving to go to like Sweden or Europe the next day or something like crazy like that. So, I mean, I was living in a parallel universe that my actions were like, whoa, we're living high. But my insides were just like, okay, well, that's it. And, you know, we had a couple other records after that and they did great. I mean, they did fine. We were on, you know, just, you know, Lowborn and Vital and put out a B-sides kind of Devotion. So, I mean, there was other records. It wasn't like that's
it. Of course,
it.
Of course.
But I attribute that to a non-meteoric rise. The worst thing a band can do is have a massive first record.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be this, where people can get to know you and get, you know, fall in love with you, and then you can have a slow decline. You do this, and everything's reactionary. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, sell your soul. Oh, you're done, you know?
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, build a slow growth fan base, man. You know, let them know you by name and, you know, where
and they'll
you're
stick around and be interested in everything that you have to say and do creatively as an artist as things go forward. That transition in your life from, okay, Amberlynn is the thing that is my full-time focus and the other things in my life are the side projects, so to speak, musically and otherwise. And when that transitional moment occurred where you were like, okay, Amberlynn can no longer be, you know, the forward-facing, all-consuming day-to-day, I need to put my focus elsewhere. And just kind of walk me through what that transition was like for you and, you know, coming to that conclusion and what led you to, you know, what you inevitably ended up doing in place of it, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, for me personally, I think if you asked each of the individual members of Amberlynn, I think we'd all have five different stories about how it ended and why it ended. But I can only speak for myself. I was fighting two wars and losing both at the same time, and I was just getting so tired that I ended up, you know, laying down my weapons. I mean, and so basically, you know, my family, my wife, and it didn't like the band. And it's not nothing personal. It's not like those guys are, it's not, you know, nothing personal. It was just, I was constantly gone. And if I wasn't gone, you know, I was songwriting or I was doing interviews or, you know, I've got, okay, we're going to do just a quick fly out or, you know, someone's flying in so we can songwrite. And so it just, she just stopped enjoying the band. I mean, it's just, especially like we had our first kid in 2011 and our second in 2013. And so here I'm widowing an orphan, orphaning, this family for 7 to 9 months a year. And it's just, it just got to the point where, everything I did for her, and for good reason, was she just, I hate it, hated it. I cannot believe you're going back to the UK. I can't believe, are you serious? Another Australian run. And years prior, it would have been like, yes, that's so cool. Congratulations. I can go do my own thing and you can do your own thing. And, we'll see you when you get back, or I'll come with you, or let's go, And so it just got heavier and heavier and heavier every day that it increased. And same with the band. They were just like, I was the only one. That was, I was the first one to be married. I was the first one to have kids. And trying to explain children to those who don't have children is a very hard task.
Absolutely.
Sitting there saying like, no, but first words are so important, or first steps are memorable, or, I just couldn't do it. And I dreaded leaving. Like I was not looking forward to the next tour. I was not looking forward to leaving the house. I was not looking forward to packing my bags, and when I was on tour, I almost had to go into a comatose emotional state where I didn't care. I didn't care about the family back at home. Not realistically, but you know what I'm saying? Like you almost had to shut down emotionally so that the pains of leaving were manageable at best. And it just got to the point where, the band was upset that I kept vetoing tours. My wife is upset that I'm actually taking tours. And after, I would say like a couple year stint of this, I was just torn in the middle. I'm just sitting here thinking, to myself, all right, here I had a dad that traveled a lot when I was young. He got off the roof when I was about 16 years old. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, I'm him. I'm recreating a scenario in which I'm absent from my children's life and some of the most memorable moments of it. And honestly, man, this is the first time I've ever told anybody this.
Yeah,
And it's just real. And I
I
think that
love it.
somebody else out there can, glean from it. And
Exactly.
so about 2013, I just realized like, okay, I was in the O2 Arena in London, and it was an incredible tour. We were, just having, obviously living the dream, and I'm miserable. I'm sitting there, and I was with a guy in the band, Joey, and I was like, Joey, dude, I'm done. Like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And he didn't, I don't know what his reaction should have been or could have been, but he just nodded his head, like as if like he knew and everyone knew, and I was the only one that didn't know. So I went back and talked to the drummer and just said, hey man, this is what I'm thinking, this is how I feel. And he was like, dude, got it. Like, Joey was passionate about becoming a producer, and Nate was excited about starting King State Coffee, and the other two guys were, Christian and Dion. They were It was tough. It was tough for them because, again, this is something we all worked our whole lives for, and it's in our laps, and we're making incredible money, and we're touring, and we're on a great record label, and it just seemed like this could go on, this could just continue. And so it was tough on them, and but I think at the back of their heads they understood. And so since that time, like a few of them have had kids, and one of the members came up to me and was just like, dude, how did you do it? And I was like, dude, and I was like, honestly, I didn't though. I didn't do it. I emotionally was unavailable for everyone. And I had to call, I, you know, five, about 4 years had passed after Emberlynn had quit. And I called each one of the guys and I said, hey man, I just want to apologize profusely for the last 2 years of being in that band. Like, 13 and 14, I was unavailable. Like I played my heart out. I wrote my heart. I worked as hard as anyone else, and never was there a moment on stage where I just, half-assed it or something like that. I gave it all. But man, emotionally, I was not present. I wasn't present for my wife. I wasn't present for my bandmates, and I just had to call and just say, I'm so sorry. I checked out. I checked out emotionally, spiritually, physically. I would everybody's, it's the last year of tour, and they're going to see the city and one last time in Moscow and one last time here and one last, and I'm like in my bunk and I'm just staring at the ceiling. I feel like, just exhausted, and even that last night of Anne Boleyn, we were, the last night of being professionals. I mean, that's how I view it. The last night of my career being based in music, was in Orlando, Florida. It was the last show that Anne Boleyn played. And at the end of the show, I collapsed to my knees with my face on the stage. And it wasn't theatrics. It literally was not theatrics. I wasn't trying to be emotional and cry for everybody. Dude, I just collapsed. I was exhausted. I literally, if they could have just quietly exited, I probably could have slept for a solid 10 hours at that second. Just because I was just emotionally and everything. It was just a relief, just that the war was over. And, that's nothing. I hope that doesn't come across negative about the guys in the band or my wife.
Not at all.
It's
not
me. At all. It's me. I assume responsibility. And so anyway, I think that, since then I've had I've had chances to talk to many different artists, and some of them were new fathers and some of them were married and planning on having, and I just had to tell them my experience. And a few of them, heeded the advice not to quit, but there's got to be balance. There just has to be, there's got to be yin and yang. There's got to be some type of zen where you can look at the other person and just say, I may not understand your situation, but I care enough to see this band last 3 or 4 more years. How much time do you need off?
Yes.
So, and we weren't to the level where the band could have said, hey, Steven, we see you're struggling. We're going to rent a second bus and you and your family follow us around the country. I mean, that would have been the ideal situation. Yeah. I mean, that would have been, well, we just couldn't afford it. That was out of the realm of financially being able to fiscally be responsible and make money at the end of the day. So, I just encourage anybody, any band out there, man, if you don't want to burn that member out, and then I would highly suggest sitting down with the families, like get your wife, get your family. And if you're single, get there anyway and understand that someday you may be at this table in a different band or in a different, outlook. But just sit down and empathize and really just understand that the bands come and go. We are not U2. We are not Rolling Stones or Metallica by any stretch of the imagination. But the person that they said I do to, hopefully will be there for the remainder of their life. Long, long after Anne Boleyn is dead, I'll be holding my wife's hand. And and same with any other band member out there. Understand that there are things that are going to matter so much more down the road and memories that you won't be able to take back. I was fine not going to my family's graduations or celebrating birthdays or, I missed my grandfather's funeral. I mean, that crushed me. We were in Brazil and I missed his funeral but I was fine cashing that in. But then when you have your own family, it's just kind of, we're playing with bigger stakes than just, a few, candles being blown out.
I can't tell. First of all, your pastoral experience shines through and that amazing advice you just gave. But secondly, I to one of your points specifically, even from a pragmatic, the most selfish of people in a band, pure business standpoint, it's like, ask yourself the question, would you rather get another year and a half of go, 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 constant road dog, never ending cycle, and then the band implodes? Or would you rather ease back on the gas pedal, come up with some balance, come up with a way that works for everyone, even if it's not how you personally want to do it, and thereby ensure some kind of greater longevity, which I think ultimately is only really possible that way. I mean, even, like you said, you're not U2, you're not the Stones, you're not Metallica. Even Metallica, the biggest heavy band in the world, got to a place where they will only tour 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. They set up a home base and fly in and out of each show. If they're doing Europe, they build a camp in Paris and, make all those little short flights. And obviously that requires a huge financial windfall to be able to do that. But it's like, even at that level, even those guys were like, we have, our wives and kids have to come first, you know, or at least be equal. And that's,
yeah,
you know, it's not sustainable otherwise. And how many people have we known in bands, you know, watching the cycle where when you're starting your band, you're 16, 17, and you know, at that time, you can't envision doing anything else. It's all you want to do. It's your dream. And you would be happy to eat ramen and sleep on floors as long as you can play shows and make records. And
absolutely.
There's a romance to that and there's a glory to it. But inevitably, everyone is going to hit that speed bump, whether it's early 20s, mid 20s, late 20s, early 30s, where they're going to say, hey, there are other things that I need from my life. And, you know, do I have to give this up entirely, or is there a way to make this work and still be able to chase my artistic muse, but do things that are more fulfilling? And a lot of times, you know, when people hear conversations like this one, a lot of what they hear is, you know, well, you got to pay the bills, you know, and you're choosing the 9 to 5 over the, I don't think that's what either one of us is talking about at all.
No.
It's more about other ways of being fulfilled as a human.
Yeah,
you know, it's too much pressure to put on your outlet as a band if that's your only source of happiness or fulfillment,
right?
You know,
and also, like, it's also a lesson to bands to work smarter and not harder. I mean, this is 2020, dude. Jump online, do an online exclusive show, you know, do multiple streams of income is where it's at. Start a clothing line, you know, make it to where, you know, you find overseas outlets that pay, you know, instead of going to tour Indonesia and some places in the Philippines, why don't you play one massive festival in Japan? You know, why don't you, you know, you just strategize better. Also, like, do acoustic renditions of your last record, or do mix, you know, remixes of it. You've got to just figure out ways that in which the band can monetize to allow you, because really, man, it's passion is elusive. Passion is like, you've got to keep, you know, the powers of be, and I'm saying the band members, passionate about what they're doing. As soon as it becomes a job, then the fans are going to notice from the stage presence. The fans are going to notice through the songwriting. It's just going to feel, the whole outfit's going to feel phoned in. It's about being authentic and real. People want that. People, and so find different ways. You know, there's, you know, Cameo right now is, you know, for $20 you can have somebody, you know, say hi to your girlfriend. Dude, that's great. Then do something like that. There's got to be multiple streams instead of saying, man, if, you know, listen, we can't keep our merch guy on retainer unless we play, you know, the next 4 months in a row.
Right.
No one's going home. You know, it's just kind of like, dude, then let's get him off retainer, introduce him to some other bands, have him go out with them in the meantime. Like, we just got to figure out, you got to make it life exciting and passionate and full of purpose. And man, it's 2020. You have no excuse to try to find it. You know, your management has no excuse to try to figure out a different stream of income.
Especially with the pandemic forcing everyone to catch up to this idea that you're talking about. And also, I think there's something to be said as an artist for having some other lived experiences to draw on from and be inspired by. If at a certain point, if your entire life is nothing but the touring and album cycle, you're going to run out of things to talk about in a way.
Yeah, really are. Yeah. I mean, someone once said you have your entire life to write your first record. And it's so true.
Yeah.
But when you get down to your fifth and you've been in the bus for 7 years, no one wants to hear back at it and back out on the road again and, you know, wheeling and dealing. I mean, nobody wants to hear that record. So you've got to go live life. You've got to be inspired.
And some of these things that we think of as these, you know, these opportunities that are impossible to ignore, I would advise people to really examine those as well, where it's like, okay, we got offered this tour with this massive band that we all grew up listening to. But then it's like, okay, but really break it down, because if you're playing at 7 p.m. in an amphitheater that's 10% full, you know, if you're only allowed to sell two t-shirts and you have to price match them at $30 each, and even maybe the band's massive and influential, but they're just playing the hits, and even a receptive crowd might be like, "Oh, this opening band's cool," and that's as far as it goes. You know,
Yep,
they're not going to give you a second thought ever again. You know, it's
yep.
like really look at those. You know, it's like it might look super cool on a piece of paper, but then it's like you do exactly like you said, work smarter, not harder. You know, you don't need to take every one of those things because the thing that's less sexy might ultimately end up being more rewarding by every measure. So,
Yep.
yeah.
Absolutely, friend. Very cool.
Well, I think that does
I
it.
don't know if we could get out, we could leave with a higher note than that. So
Yeah,
that's pretty perfect.
that is so amazing, and I appreciate your candor and you know, being open about all this stuff because I think to your point, absolutely, someone's going to hear this at that exact moment when they need it to. You know,
Good. Yeah.
because that's the thing with bands, especially in that whole cycle. Nobody tells you this might be as good as it gets. Let's make some plans,
Yeah,
because
so
those
true.
people are fired. You know,
Yep.
bands only want everyone around them that's like it's gonna keep going up. It's still going forever.
Yep, you're right.
So, well, Stephen, thank you so much, and thank you again for making the time. I greatly appreciate it, and
Yeah.
I'll make sure that you know everything surrounding the episode has all the info about Anchor and Braille and everything you've got
Cool.
going on and where people can find you and all that stuff. So,
Incredible. And listen, man, if you're ever in Florida, let's hang out. You
dude, I would
know,
love that.
I'll that would be rad. That'd be so cool. I'm sure we have plenty of war stories to go back and forth about.
Absolutely. And yeah, and there's a great little, it was unintentional how this happened, but there's a great little succession of tooth and nail episodes en route because I have yours in the bank. I have Spencer from Under Oath in the bank, and I just did another one with Ryan Clark, which is the first repeat guest.
Nice,
So,
dude. Ryan Clark is a man. He's a hero. That guy, he's so intelligent on multitude of levels. I just theologically, like, I feel like creative wise, like he's up to, he's a exclusive, man. He's up there. So that's
could
awesome.
not agree more. Could not agree more.
Very cool.
Well, cool, man. Yeah, go spend some time with your
All
family,
right,
and
you
yeah,
got it.
and definitely next, you know, when we're all traveling around a little bit more, and next time I'm your way, I would love to hang out for sure.
Sounds good, Ryan.
Awesome.
We'll
Thanks,
talk
Stephen.
soon.
All right,
Yes,
brother.
sir.
Bye
All
bye.
right, bye.